Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 22nd, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. We'll begin with the local news on page one. The first headline reads, Should CR adopt ranked choice voting? Charter Review Commission to consider question today, by Marissa Payne. Citizens chose Cedar Rapids municipal flag through ranked choice voting. The concept, essentially instant runoff voting, may seem unfamiliar, but its supporters say ranked choice voting is less costly than having a runoff election, results in higher voter turnout, discourages negative campaigning, and leads to the election of candidates who are favored by a broad swath of voters. Advocates believe Cedar Rapids is Iowa's second largest city, with a trend of Republican mayors serving a Democratic-leaning city, is the prime spot to pilot ranked choice voting and to lobby state lawmakers to make the system legal in Iowa cities. The once-a-decade Cedar Rapids charter review process offers an opportunity for city officials and a citizen panel to consider whether to change the way the city's elections are run. Ultimately, whether to have primary elections, runoff elections, or a ranked choice system is not up to the 9-member Cedar Rapids Charter Review Commission. It would take a change in Iowa law before ranked choice voting is allowed, and the City Council would have to sign off on any recommended changes. The Charter Review Commission will hear a presentation about ranked choice voting when it meets at 11:30 a.m. today in the City Hall Training Room, 101 First Street Southeast. The Commission could recommend the Council adopt trigger language so the City would go to ranked choice voting if Iowa law is changed to allow it, suggest language directing the council to appoint a new commission to consider the issue if ranked choice voting becomes allowed under Iowa law, decide against recommending ranked choice voting. At this time, a runoff is held if no candidate receives 50% plus one vote in the November general election. Matt Wettstein, director of Better Ballot Iowa, the nonprofit calling for the adoption of ranked choice voting in Iowa, said ranked choice voting can improve the divisive, negative political climate caused by plurality. With about 10% of the group's members living in Cedar Rapids, he said, it made strategic sense to focus on a discussion about ranked choice voting here. Ranked choice voting automatically builds more accountability between the elected leaders and the public because elected leaders have to look outside their own pluralities, Wettstein said. Multiple rounds of runoffs can be conducted under a ranked choice system to decide a given contest, essentially the same as holding a runoff, except people don't have to cast ballots again. They rank their preferences right on the November ballot. That also means a potentially different and often smaller group of voters than in a general election will be deciding the winner of a runoff election. In ranked choice voting, voters don't have to rank all the candidates, Wettstein said, but that's a choice the voter gets to make. Cedar Rapids just turned out to be a perfect example of where this is beneficial, Wettstein said. Why Cedar Rapids? The November runoff election in the race for mayor worked as well as it could have, Wettstein said. The mayor was the clear winner, no matter how you cut it, Wettstein said, of Tiffany O'Donnell's election as mayor. She was the top vote getter in the general and the runoff elections held 4 weeks apart. Though the result was conclusive, Wettstein said, it came at a cost, around $80,000 to hold the runoff. Plus the candidates, O'Donnell, opponent Amara Andrews, and incumbent Brad Hart, raised $483,776 in campaign funds as they vied for mayor. There also was lower turnout in the runoff election. In the November 2nd election, 26,248 votes were cast in the mayoral race. In the November 30th runoff, 19,898 citizens voted, a turnout of 21.43% of the city's 92,832 eligible voters. Wettstein said O'Donnell, a registered Republican who campaigned as being for the party of Cedar Rapids in the nonpartisan race for mayor, represents a very broad consensus mayor who's able to talk to a wide constituency and who is able to straddle two sides of the partisan leaning in the state. As such, he said, she makes a good advocate for the issue. Among Iowa cities his group has examined, Wettstein said Cedar Rapids probably has the longest history of elections where it's clear ranked choice voting would have resulted in the election of a more broadly favored candidate. In the years when only at-large council seats were on the ballot, there is often a more than 50% drop in turnout, pointing to at-large council races in 2005, 2009, and 2013. For example, in 2013, council incumbent Chuck Swore emerged as the top vote-getter in the November general election, with 7,950 votes in a field of seven candidates vying for two at-large seats. Swore was just slightly below the threshold needed to avoid a runoff. In the runoff, with the three lowest vote-getters out of the running, Swore received 2,895 votes, the fewest of the four remaining candidates. Carletta Knox Seymour finished third, receiving about 62% of the votes Swore received in the general election. Ralph Russell and Susie Weinacht won the two council seats. You're hoping that the runoff is going to add more voters to the winning candidates so you can say the winning candidates in the runoff did better than in the general election, and not just in percentage but in actual number of votes, Wettstein said. That didn't happen here. Local elections provide a gateway to push for change at the state and federal levels, Wettstein said, and in Iowa that change could start with Cedar Rapids, he said. There's no perfect system, but we feel that it is a far better system than what Cedar Rapids currently has, better than other options available in state law, Wettstein said. We hope that this is a real step forward not only for Cedar Rapids, but for the rest of the state to consider this. Videos on ranked choice voting and slides specific to Cedar Rapids can be viewed at betterballotiowa.org/cedar-rapids. Murder trial for Flowers remains in Linn County. Judge rules media coverage has not been pervasive or inflammatory, by Trish Mahaffey. A judge this week denied moving a murder trial for a man accused of beating to death a woman with a board, ruling media coverage hasn't been pervasive or inflammatory or sensational. The trial of Arthur J. Flowers, 62, of Cedar Rapids, charged with first-degree murder, will remain in Linn County. It is set to start Tuesday. 6th Judicial District Judge Faye Hoover heard arguments last week from the defense, claiming news coverage had been inflammatory and pervasive from some media, which created prejudice against Flowers and would prevent him from selecting a fair and impartial jury. Hoover, in a ruling filed Sunday, said usually after a crime is committed, there is a flurry of news reports, and there are typically follow-up reports on any continuances and pretrial hearings. The media's coverage in this case follows the ordinary pattern, Hoover wrote. Neither the depth nor frequency of the media coverage in the record can be characterized as pervasive. None of the media coverage in the record is inflammatory or sensational. Last week, Flowers' lawyers asked Hoover to suppress statements Flowers made to police during an interview April 2nd, arguing he wasn't fully aware of his rights and consequences of waiving those rights. Hoover hasn't filed a ruling on the suppression motion. On April 2nd, officers responded to a 911 call at 6:06 p.m. made by Flowers, who reported a woman later identified as Emily Leonard, 22, of Cedar Rapids, had overdosed on heroin at his house. According to the criminal complaint, Flowers tried to leave when officers arrived, but then took them to a bathroom where Leonard's body was found. Police found a bloodied 1x6-inch board, which investigators believe was the murder weapon, based on the woman's head injuries, the complaint stated. Investigators said they found blood evidence in another area of the home where Leonard was likely killed and then her body moved. During an interview with police, Flowers said he was alone with Leonard, a person he had known for many years, from Friday through Saturday, when he called in the heroin overdose, according to the complaint. Flowers provided details about the incident that were not consistent with a crime scene, police said. He also appeared to have blood on his hands. Iowa Dems to pitch simpler presidential selection process. They hope changes will keep Iowa at the front of the pack. By Tom Barton. Iowa Democrats make their pitch Thursday to the Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee as to why they should remain an early voting state in the nation's presidential nominating process. State party officials will present proposed changes to its caucuses that modernize and streamline the process. The goal, secure a renewed place at the front of their party's presidential nominating calendar. The Republican National Committee in April voted unanimously to keep Iowa at the front of the line in the GOP's presidential selection process. Iowa is among 16 states and Puerto Rico vying to be included in Democrats' early presidential nominating window ahead of Super Tuesday in early March 2024. The DNC Rules Committee voted in April to reopen the presidential nominating window, forcing all interested states, including the current early nominating states of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, to apply for a spot. The move came after the current lineup of early nominating states came under increasing fire following a chaotic 2020 caucus night for Iowa Democrats, when a smartphone app meant to make reporting results easier failed. As a result, the official Democratic caucus results were not reported for several weeks. Critics have slammed Iowa's first-in-the-nation status over the state's lack of diversity and electoral competitiveness. And National Democrats complain the caucuses are too opaque and inaccessible, requiring in-person attendance, which can make them difficult to attend for Iowans who work late shifts, lack access to childcare or transportation, or have health or mobility problems. To make their caucuses more accessible, Iowa Democrats are proposing to eliminate the requirement for in-person attendance and are reorganizing the caucus practice of identifying candidates' viability over multiple rounds. The DNC Rules Committee is expected to meet in early August and recommend up to 5 states for the early nominating window. Under the proposed changes, an Iowa Democrat would request a presidential preference card in the mail and would have 14 to 28 days to either mail it back or return it in person on caucus night. On caucus night, the Iowa Democratic Party would report the results publicly. The caucuses themselves would focus primarily on conducting party business, such as electing delegates to county conventions. The state party also would contract with either a DNC-approved election vendor or with a county auditor or the Iowa Secretary of State's office to ensure a fair and trustworthy process. The Iowa Democratic Party chairman, Ross Wilburn, has said the changes will make the caucuses more straightforward, accessible, and professional. While the nominating process should always be subject to critical examination, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina serve our party well as an accessible cross-section of the National Democratic electorate, and each state presents a unique, important test for presidential hopefuls, Wilburn wrote in a letter to the DNC. Iowa code requires political parties hold caucuses at least 8 days before any other state's primary. Caucuses in Iowa have a history of higher turnout than many other states' presidential nominating contests, despite some historical barriers, Wilburn wrote. Those who will present Thursday to the DNC Rules Committee will be Wilburn, Iowa House Democratic leader Jennifer Confirst of Windsor Heights, Democratic State Representative Ross Smith of Waterloo, and Scott Brennan, a chairman and on the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee. I think our presentation will show Iowa is much more diverse than they think, and there are many forms of diversity, Brennan said. One of the forms of diversity that Iowa brings, frankly, is the rural working class diversity, and it's a group of folks Democrats have forgotten how to talk to, he said. And if we can't figure that out under the Electoral College system, we'll be doomed to win popular votes and lose the Electoral College. And that's criminal, and that's on us if we can't figure that out. Governor signs law that eliminates open enrollment deadline in Iowa. Reynolds takes action on the 3 remaining bills from the 2022 legislative session. By Aaron Murphy. Students can apply to open enroll to another public school district at any point in the year under a new law approved Tuesday by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. It was among 3 bills that Reynolds signed into law Tuesday, completing her work on all legislation that was passed this year by state lawmakers. The elimination of the previous March 1st deadline for an open enrollment request was one of the last pieces of legislation approved during the session after it became apparent that majority Republicans did not have enough votes to pass Reynolds' so-called school choice bill, which included a program that would have diverted state funding for public schools to private school tuition assistance. The March 1st deadline for open enrollment requests was put in place so school districts could plan for how many students they will have during the following school year. And the previous state law included exemptions to the deadline for students who faced issues such as bullying. Jack Whitford, the Republican Senate Majority Leader from Ankeny, said recently on Iowa Press, that State House Republicans felt removing the deadline was an important aspect of their school choice agenda. Whitford cited recent policies codified by the Linmar School District to protect transgender students from discrimination. Some parents, upset by the policies, which had been in place in practice in the district for years, requested and were granted a private meeting with Reynolds and U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, both Republicans. Really, anything the parents find that they don't like about that school could be a reason for an open enrollment request, Whitford said on Iowa Press. Obviously, one of the high-profile ones is what was going on in Marion when they rolled out a transgender policy shortly after that March 1st deadline. Parents are saying, what is our alternative? And we don't think there is one. So we wanted to open that up, but that's just one reason. It could be anything. School officials and Democrats who opposed the proposal warned that it will make it more difficult for districts to plan for the following school year. The measure was included in the Iowa Legislature Standings Bill, which is a catch-all budget and policy bill that is often one of the last to be approved during a legislative session. This year's Standings Bill, House File 2589, also contained a new ban on private funding for local elections operations. That provision was created in response to the reported $419 million in grants funded by Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg that were designed to help election officials operate the 2020 elections during the COVID-19 pandemic. Scott County, $286,870, and Blackhawk County, $267,500, received grants in 2020, according to court documents produced after a group sued the counties unsuccessfully over the grants. I do not believe that there should be conservative, wealthy people doing that, and I do not believe there should be liberal, wealthy people doing that, Iowa Representative Bobby Kaufman, a Republican from Wilton and chair of the House's State Government Committee, said during the session. I'm not comfortable, and I have yet to encounter anybody that can give me a reasonable counter debate on why private dollars with, in my opinion, special political interests in mind, should be able to contribute directly to the election officials conducting their business. Small artisanal butchers that produce custom meats will get some help from the state and legislation signed into law by Reynolds. The new law is the result of recommendations made by a state task force that was convened last year to study ways the state could help small butchers. Small butchers in Iowa have said they are dealing with increased demand by consumers seeking artisanal and custom meats, often from farm-to-table producers, and are beset with supply chain issues caused by disruption in commercial meat processing due to the coronavirus pandemic. Under the new law, the state will create a one-year artisanal butchery certificate program for community colleges to offer. The state education department is instructed to compile resources for meat processing plants that include information on an existing butchery grant program, apprenticeships and internships, and worker training and development. The legislation, House File 2470, was approved unanimously by state lawmakers. This bill is a win for Iowa's livestock producers, our agriculture industry, and our entire state, Reynolds said in a statement to the Bureau. It strengthens the partnership between our community colleges and departments of education, workforce development, and agriculture to provide much-needed support to Iowa's local meat lockers and butchery programs. On Tuesday, Reynolds also signed into law House File 2581, which contains myriad programs under the state agriculture department. Reynolds picks Ryswick to fill State Board of Regents vacancy. Seneca Company's president has donated to fund for governor's campaign, by Vanessa Miller. 4 months after Milt Dakovich, a longtime member of the State Board of Regents, died of cancer, Governor Kim Reynolds on Tuesday named Seneca Company's president James J.C. Ryswick to fill the regent vacancy. Ryswick will begin serving on the 9-member board that governs Iowa's 3 public universities and 2 special schools immediately, though his appointment will require confirmation by the Iowa Senate when it is next in session. The regents' next meeting is July 27th, when they'll consider raising tuition rates for the fall. If confirmed, Ryswick will serve out the remainder of Dakovich's 6-year term, set to expire in April 2025, after Dakovich was reappointed to a second stint in March 2019. Ryswick serves as president and chief operating officer of Seneca Companies in Des Moines, which touts itself as an established leader in the petroleum industry. Chris Ryswick, J.C. Ryswick's father, founded Seneca in 1972 with a vision to deliver real value to customers in the petroleum industry through supplying quality equipment, innovative service, and dependable construction of fueling sites, according to the company's website. State law requires the Board of Regents to be balanced politically and by gender, meaning no political party or gender can have more than 5 representatives. Ryswick's appointment keeps the gender balance at 4 men and 5 women. Before Dakovich's passing, the board had 5 Republicans, 3 politically unaffiliated members, and 1 registered Democrat, Regent Nancy Dunkel. The announcement of Ryswick's appointment didn't include his political affiliation, but state campaign disclosure documents show he contributed $20,000 to Reynolds' campaign in 2021, and over the past 3 years has made in-kind contributions in the form of private flights valued at nearly $40,000. Christopher Ryswick has contributed $15,500 to Reynolds' campaign over the past 7 years, state campaign disclosure documents show. He also made an in-kind contribution in the form of a private flight in 2020 valued at more than $25,800. J.C. Ryswick volunteers through ChildServe and Impact Iowa's Heroes and was named among the 40 under 40 in Iowa in 2014, according to Reynolds' announcement. J.C. is an outstanding leader with a passion for making our state a better place, Reynolds said in a statement. I'm confident his expertise, experience, and innovative mindset will inspire our Regent universities in their mission to prepare the next generation of college students to flourish in the workforce. In praising Iowa's universities for leading the way, Reynolds said, J.C. will help push them to new heights. I also want to thank the late Milt Dakovich for his service over the last 9 years, she said. He had a profound impact on our Regent universities and the students they serve. In a statement, Ryswick thanked Reynolds for the appointment. I look forward to serving the citizens of Iowa, he said. I will work diligently with the fellow board members to keep upper education at Iowa's public universities on the forefront and leading edge of the 21st century. Ryswick earned a business degree from Miami University and completed the Minnesota Management Institute at the University of Minnesota. UI researcher lands grant to study long-haul COVID. Chronic lung disease is recognized as a debilitating outcome of COVID-19 by Vanessa Miller. A University of Iowa healthcare researcher is among 21 nationally to receive an American Lung Association award worth hundreds of thousands for COVID-19 and respiratory virus research. He is looking specifically at long-haul COVID. Sean Fain, a radiology professor in the UI Division of Cardiovascular and Thoracic Imaging, received the Lung Association's award, which includes up to $100,000 annually for up to 2 years, for his project titled Understanding Long-Haul COVID-19. The research, among at least 10 ongoing UI-based COVID-related clinical studies and trials, aims to investigate blood vessel injury in COVID patients and methods for improving lung inflammation treatments. Chronic lung disease is recognized as a debilitating outcome of COVID-19, according to Fain's project description. Patients who suffer from chronic symptoms post-COVID-19 are sometimes referred to as long haulers, in which the chronic aftereffects of infection impair quality of life. In severe cases, according to Fain's project pitch, COVID triggers an immune response when it enters the body, causing inflammation and injury to blood vessels. Blood vessel injuries in the lungs can create scarring known as interstitial lung disease, a condition that remains even after COVID infection resolves. Fain, through his Lung Association-funded research, will study injured blood vessels in COVID patients using imaging and blood biomarkers that measure inflammation and repair. The biomarkers indicate active blood vessel injury and will be used to monitor functional lung decline and improvement before and after treatment in patients with post-COVID-19 lung disease, according to Fain's proposal. Fain, with his initial $100,000 award, joins a cohort of American researchers receiving a total of $12.6 million via 100-plus lung health grants, including those directly related to the pandemic. In a statement, American Lung Association Executive Director Mickey Sandquist reported COVID long haulers are growing more prevalent. Many of us know someone, be it a family member, coworker, or friend, who is suffering from long COVID symptoms, Sandquist said in a statement. As a society, we need research like Dr. Fain's to help all the long haulers in our lives heal from the damaging effects of this lung disease. Researchers and projects granted Lung Association funding are carefully selected through a rigorous review committee and represent the investigation of a wide range of complex issues to help reduce the burden of lung disease. The goal of the COVID-19 research is to curtail ongoing burdens from the virus through exploration of new treatment approaches and better understanding of complex immune responses. These areas of focus, the immune system's response, how the virus causes pathology, and applying public health to help identify risk factors and how we can reduce community spread, are important linchpins in our ability to reduce the burden of COVID-19 in the U.S., according to the American Lung Association. Other researchers conducting similar Lung Association grant-funded work are from Central Washington University, Yale University, and Massachusetts General Hospital. Per the rules, grants are subject to annual review and second-year funding is contingent on demonstration of satisfactory progress as well as the availability of funding from the Lung Association. No more than a quarter of a project's requested budget can go towards salary or fringe benefits, and no more than 30% of the total award can go to buy equipment. UI Healthcare in 2020 established a post-COVID clinic, and its researchers earlier this year produced findings from a study showing physical changes to the small airways and lungs might explain breathing problems characterized as long-haul COVID. The symptoms, according to that research, could appear in patients with both severe and less severe sickness. Researchers came to their conclusions by analyzing CT scans of 100 patients at the Iowa City-based UI post-COVID clinic. Now here's a feature story from the first page. From farming and video games to real life, Ankeny, 21-year-old, made enough money from YouTube videos to help him buy his own farm. By Aaron Jordan. Grant Hilbert always knew he wanted to be a farmer, but figured he'd have to work 20 or 30 years in another profession to afford to buy land in Iowa. Turns out he needed just 6 years of playing video games. Hilbert, 21, of Ankeny, made enough money from YouTube videos of him playing the Farming Simulator video game to help him buy 250 acres in Poweshiek and Mahaska counties that he now has planted in corn and soybeans. "That was always my life goal, but it just happened sooner than I thought," he said. Before anyone gets a mental image of a slacker getting rich off video games, know that Hilbert filmed, edited, and posted a video nearly every day he was enrolled in classes at Iowa State University, where he earned a degree in agricultural business and economics in 2020. He has more than 1.3 million followers on his The Squad YouTube channel because he comes up with fresh ideas for videos, including once when he and his friends built a racetrack within Farming Simulator and held a virtual race. In a recent video, he still posts several Farming Simulator videos a week, Hilbert and Chandler Book, who Hilbert hired to help film videos, role-play buying a tractor at auction. The video had 55,000 views and 84 comments within 24 hours. Hilbert and a friend started the Squad channel in 2014 when they were in 10th grade, first playing an assortment of popular video games. "Me and my buddy were business-minded. We went into it knowing you could make some money from YouTube," he said. Within a few months, the channel was just Hilbert, and he was mostly playing just Farming Simulator, a video game series developed by Giant Software and launched in 2008 that lets players virtually grow crops, breed livestock, and sell assets created from farming. When Hilbert went to college in 2016, a new Farming Simulator version came out, and Hilbert tapped into renewed interest. He took classes at ISU from about 8 a.m. to 2 p.m., filmed videos in the afternoon, and then edited and posted the videos each night. "I didn't have the fun college experience like a lot of other people. I was doing YouTube," he said. More than one-third of U.S. farmland was inherited or gifted by a family member, and another 16% was purchased from a relative, according to a 2016 study by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service. Hilbert couldn't do either of those things. His grandparents and uncles farmed near Algona, but Hilbert's parents, Barney and Rita, moved from the farm to Ankeny, where Barney works with supply chains for Corteva, and Rita is a home loan mortgage officer. During his junior and senior years at ISU, Hilbert started scouting land brokerage websites looking for Iowa farmland. He bought his first farm right after college graduation. He later bought two more farms in the same area of southern Poweshiek County and northern Mahaska County near Montezuma. All three parcels, totaling about 250 acres, cost more than $1.8 million combined. "I am borrowing a lot of money to buy these farms," he said. "I use a lot of leverage. I would say 60% of the down payment was from videos and 40% from investments." Hilbert owns Bitcoin and invested in the Mining Store, a Bitcoin mining site in Grundy County. "Kudos to him for finding an avenue to do what he loves," said Iowa Farm Bureau Federation President Brent Johnson when he heard about Hilbert. "There's a lot of farmers on social media telling their stories. I absolutely love that." Everything Hilbert does on the farm is fodder for videos for the Grant Hilbert channel on YouTube, which has 129,000 subscribers and 50 videos. His May 16th video, First Day of Corn Planting 2022, has more than 69,000 views. The 19-minute video starts off with Hilbert selecting among five vintage caps to wear for the occasion. Then he and Brother Spencer climb in the John Deere planter and get to work. "We can crank it up to 12 mile, well, not 12 mile an hour," he said. "We can crank it up to 12th gear," Spencer added. "12th gear, about 8.5 mile an hour," Grant Hilbert said. Fans of the 1994 movie Dumb and Dumber will enjoy the April 21st, 2020 video, "We Bought a New Tractor, John Deere 1026R, which has nearly 935,000 views. Hilbert said he hasn't had any epic fails, but even small glitches can make compelling videos. Take, for example, noobs rebuilding a hydraulic cylinder and spilling corn on the go. "There's a lot more older audience on the Real Life channel," Hilbert said. "They might be retired or just wanting to watch a young guy farming." He estimates about 40% of his audience on either channel is a crossover from the other channel. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 22nd, 2022 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Iris Mae Snyder of Marion. A memorial service is planned for First Presbyterian Church in Marion on Saturday, June 25th at 2 p.m. to honor Iris Mae Snyder of Bentley Village, Naples, Florida. On December 4th, 2021, she passed away peacefully, having just celebrated her 90th birthday. Iris, a resident of Florida since 1986, lived in Bonita Bay and Bonita Springs for most of those years. Born in Garner, Iowa on November 24th, 1931, she attended schools in Clemmy, graduating in 1949. In 1952, she graduated from the Iowa Methodist School of Nursing, where she met her longtime husband, Richard, of nearly 69 years. A longtime member of First Presbyterian Church of Marion, Iris served as an elder, was an active member of the choir, was involved in youth fellowship leadership, and served on the Banner Committee. In Florida, she was a member of the First Presbyterian Church of Bonita Springs, attended the Great Banquet, was a Stephen minister, and a proud member of the Banner Committee. She was an accomplished seamstress, a long-term member of PEO and OOP organizations, enjoyed golf, three aces, bridge, traveling, volunteering, and hospitality. Iris' last experience in nursing was at Sedlicek Treatment Center, a substance abuse center in Cedar Rapids, which she described as a total life changer. After receiving an associate arts degree in interior design from Kirkwood Community College, she owned a decorating den franchise. Her Christian faith, family, and friends were her real focus in life. Her motto for life was, "On Christ, the solid rock, I stand." Memorials can be sent to First Presbyterian Church of Marion. Charles E. Gentry, 91, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died Saturday, June 18, 2022. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday, June 24, 2022, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Burial will follow at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Charles was born March 9, 1931, in Carmi, Illinois, the son of Clarence and Anne Quentin Gentry. He served honorably in the United States Army from 1952 to 54. Charles was united in marriage to Bonnie Lou Spencer on July 18, 1958. He worked for Wilson Packing House for 35 years until his retirement. Charles was a member of the First Church of the Nazarene in Cedar Rapids. He was a foster parent to several children. Survivors include his children, David, Linda, Stuber of Charlotte, North Carolina, and Scott Gentry of Cedar Rapids, and niece, Donna K. Duncan of Tennessee. He was preceded in death by his parents, Clarence and Ann Gentry, wife, Bonnie Gentry, and sister, Margaret Adams. Please share a memory of Charles at MurdochFuneralHome.com under obituaries. Jerry Mack Jordan, 82, of Center Point, Iowa, passed away on Monday, June 20th, 2022, at his home. Memorial service, 2 p.m. Friday, June 24th, 2022, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point. Jerry was born on March 15, 1940, in Waverly, Iowa, the son of Claude and Mary Lucille McGregor Jordan. After high school, Jerry honorably served his country in the United States Navy during Vietnam. On February 8, 1961, he was united in marriage to Kathleen Hirsch at St. John's Lutheran Church in Nashua. Jerry was a sheet metal worker for Sheet Metal Workers Local No. 2. He was a dog and horse trainer who also owned and operated Kojak Kennels. Jerry was a member of the German Shorthair Pointer Club of Eastern Iowa. Jerry was quite a character who loved a good joke. He will be missed by those who knew and loved him. Judith B. Kincaid Jarvis of Keosauqua, born September 16, 1944, a loving wife, mother, and friend, went to the Lord and her waiting family on June 15, 2022. She lived a rich life and enjoyed spending time with family and friends, whether it was in the kitchen, garage, or out fishing. She loved to camp and spend time outdoors. She is survived by children Russell, Stephen, Michael, Vicky, Clank, and James, Al, sister Janet, and brother Tom, as well as many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Judith was preceded in death by parents John and Bernice and sisters Velma Jean and Joyce. Judy will be missed by all. Friends may leave online condolences at CranstonFamilyFuneralHome.com. A celebration of life will be held Saturday, September 3rd, from 1 to 4 p.m. at Lake McBride Shelter No. 1. Kevin Craig Sillick, 67, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Monday, June 20th, 2022, after a one-year battle with cancer. Kevin was born on January 19th, 1955, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Vernon and Helen Roseberry Sillick. He graduated from Washington High School, then went to work maintenance for Collins Radio, where he stayed for 49 years. He could build or fix anything mechanical, but had difficulty fixing soup. Domestic chores, like making a meal, were duties he had no time or inclination for. Kevin's happy place was on a motorcycle. His perfect day was waking up to a warm, sunny day, but not too early, as that's when he got his usual 3 to 4 hours of sleep, putting on all his gear and riding off to places like the back roads of Wisconsin. He'd stop at some point for a burger and ice cream, ride some more, deep in his own thoughts, and then get back to town in time to have a big steak dinner at Outback Steakhouse with his friend Mike. He would then ride around town some more and then stop at First Avenue Dairy Queen for more ice cream and visit with a friend who would invariably show up. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Timothy Paul Odine, 49, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died unexpectedly Sunday, June 19, 2022. A memorial service will be held Monday, June 27, 2022, at Sharon United Methodist Church in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will begin at 2 p.m., with the service following at 3 p.m. A private interment will be held later. Tim was born March 17, 1973, in Cedar Rapids to Harry and Linda Wilcox Odine. He graduated from Metro High School. Tim enjoyed being a ham radio operator and building and repairing computers. Watching football on TV was another favorite pastime. Survivors include his parents, Harry and Linda Odine of Cedar Rapids, and siblings, Tina Gruby of Aptos, California, and Todd Candy Odine of Cedar Rapids. He is also survived by several aunts and uncles, multiple cousins, and good friends. Tim was preceded in death by both sets of grandparents, Mr. and Mrs. Harry Odine and Mr. and Mrs. Paul Wilcox. Several aunts and uncles also have preceded him. Please share a memory of Tim at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Lee Alexandra Schilling, beloved daughter of Everett Schilling of Rural Al Burnett and Allison Toe of Colorado Springs, Colorado, passed away on June 6, 2022 in a Denver hospital at the age of 30. Lee was born prematurely on December 5, 1991 with congenital heart defects. At the age of 2 days, she was rushed to Iowa City, where she had her first heart surgery. She had a second heart surgery at the age of 5. Several months prior to her death, Lee underwent a valve replacement and was doing well until infection set in and overcame her body. Lee graduated from Air Academy High School in Colorado Springs in 2010 and from Pikes Peak Community College in 2012 with a degree in multimedia graphic design. Lee worked for Blue Star Recycling and was a dog sitter. Dogs and cats were the love of her life. She also had a passion for horses and spent time with her step-grandma Pam's horses when she visited Iowa. Lee had an infectious smile, beautiful blue eyes, a caring personality, and a generous heart. Her hands were seldom idle. If she wasn't knitting a thoughtful creation for someone, she was making thoughtful cards, never missing a holiday. Her mind was always on giving to others. Family and friends are invited to a gathering at the home of Lee's dad in rural Al Burnett on Sunday, June 26th, from noon to 2 p.m., in remembrance of Lee. May Lee's smiling soul shine on. Lowell Virgil Barnhart, Barney, 74, of Greenville, Texas, left this earth peacefully on March 26, 2022. Lowell was a veteran who proudly served in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. Barney was a man of few words, with a quick wit and a sarcastic sense of humor. He grew up on the family farm near Wyoming, Iowa, and graduated from Midland Community Schools. He loved the family farm and would return every year for his mother's birthday and to fish the pond, walk the timber, hunt mushrooms, and spend time with his family and daughter Rachel. Rachel, his only child, brought much joy to Lowell during their visits. He was a machine operator employed for 15 years by Weyerhaeuser Corp. in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and later employed by Johnson Controls in Middletown, Delaware for 20 years. He retired in 2009 and moved to the Virginia Mountains with Jean, his wife and best friend of 40 years, and their two dogs. He enjoyed working outside or watching the deer and wild turkeys. In 2015, Lowell and Jean relocated to Greenville, Texas. A celebration of life in his honor will be held Saturday, June 25th at Rack's Swinging Door in Wyoming, Iowa, from noon to 4 p.m. Randy Thomas Gilmore, 59, of Springville, passed away June 9, 2022 after suffering a stroke. He fought for 9 days before succumbing while surrounded by his family. Randy, also known as Rock by his family, grew up on their family dairy farm in Springville, Iowa, before eventually relocating to Phoenix. He loved many things, but what he lived for was riding enduro. In his youth, he raced competitively all over the country. After several years and several major accidents later, he never gave up and never slowed down. By far his favorite place to ride was in Taylor Park, Colorado, where he felt the trails pushed him to higher levels and greeted him with the best scenery. As fast as he was, Randy took the time to appreciate his surroundings, love the people he was there with, and was always the helping hand to any and all along the way. Although Randy was an incredibly humble and kind soul, he was extremely proud of his family. He never took the time to settle down, but instead chose to live and share his life with everyone. He was embraced by his cousin as a father figure, and even more as a grandfather to his cousin's children. It gave him tremendous joy the first time he was able to see the boys ripping through the grass on their electric bikes. Randy's celebration of life will be a private event. Please contact Tanya Burke for information. Muriel L. Duncan, 102, of Anamosa, formerly of Morley, passed away on June 18, 2022. After her 102nd birthday, she contracted COVID and never really recovered. Honoring her wishes, she will be cremated and there will be no funeral. A celebration of her life and interment will be held at a later date. Please visit GetchOnline.com and share your thoughts, memories, stories, and condolences with Muriel's family. Muriel Laverta Hunter was born August 13, 1919, in Morley, the eldest child of Lloyd E. Babe and L. Pearl Clymer Hunter. She attended school in Morley and Olin and graduated from Morley Consolidated School in 1937. She worked as a clerk at several stores before her marriage to Roland Lawrence Duncan on June 29, 1942. They were the parents of four children. During World War II, she was a collar setter at the Reliance Shirt Factory in Anamosa and worked in assembly at Fruithoff's in Cedar Rapids. She was the bookkeeper for the Morley Telephone Company for 17 years and served as the postmaster in Morley for 24 years. She and her husband lived on the Duncan Century Farm for 19 years. Together with their friend, Millie Cook, Muriel and Lawrence worked in interior decorating for a number of years. She also was in charge of the Morley Library for a number of years. Memorials may be directed to the Iowa Department for the Blind, 524 4th Street, Des Moines, Iowa, 50309. Samuel E. Schneider, 78, of West Liberty, passed away Thursday, June 16, 2022, at the Simpson Memorial Home in West Liberty. Graveside services will be held 10:30 a.m. Monday, June 27, 2022, at the Oak Ridge Cemetery, West Liberty. The Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Liberty is caring for Sam's family. Memorials may be made to the West Liberty Gun Club. Samuel Eugene Schneider was born September 4, 1943, in Iowa City, the son of Leroy and Virginia Bennett Schneider. He was a graduate of West Liberty High School in the class of 1961. Following graduation, Sam served in the United States Army Reserves. On March 9, 1963, he was united in marriage to Mary F. Meyer in West Liberty. Sam had been employed with Procter & Gamble in Iowa City for many years, retiring in 1995. He was a member of West Liberty Jaycees, Lions Club, bowled with the Outhouse Gang, a P&G group, and a member of the West Liberty Gun Club. He enjoyed woodworking, guns, cars, tractors, and his dogs. Cleota Mary Slazak Stute, died at age 98 on June 14, 2022, at Crestview Nursing Home in West Branch. Cleo was preceded in death by Clarence, her husband of 51 years, all her siblings, and her longtime companion, Charles Funk. She is survived by her son, Stephen, Ruth Ann, two grandsons, Mark, Wendy, and Carl, Becky, and two great-grandsons, Gabriel Stute and Felix Stute. A service will be held on Friday, June 24, 2022, visitation beginning at 10 a.m. with a service at 11 a.m. at Gayanchia Funeral Home, 2720 Muscatine Avenue, Iowa City, Iowa, 52240. For a full obituary and to express memories and condolences, please visit gayanchia.com. Dolores May Palmer, 93, of Mount Auburn, died after a short illness surrounded by family on Sunday, June 19, 2022, at the Virginia Gay Hospital. Services 10:30 a.m. on Saturday at Mount Auburn United Methodist Church by Pastor Luke Evans. Burial, Mount Auburn Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family on Saturday after 9:30 a.m. at the church. Van Steenhouse Tea and Funeral Home is serving the family. Robert William Barrage, 87, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Monday, June 13, 2022, at his home. The family will greet friends and family from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 24th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, Iowa. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 25th at the Lutheran Church of the Resurrection. located at 3500 29th Avenue Marion, where additional visitation will take place 1 hour to the ahead of the service. Dale N. Collingwood, 82, of Marengo, passed away Monday, June 20, 2022, at Compass Memorial Healthcare. Funeral service, 11 a.m., Friday, June 24, 2022, at St. John's Lutheran Church, Marengo, with Reverend Andrew Gray officiating. Military honors will be conducted following the service by the Williamsburg VFW. Interment will be at a later date. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m., Thursday, June 23, 2022, at Closter Funeral Home, Marengo. Memorials may be contributed to the Monarchs of Eastern Iowa or Essence of Life. That concludes today's obituaries. We'll move on to the editorial page. There is one letter to the editor today. It is from Dan Voss of Atkins and is headlined, "Pay Attention to the January 6th Hearings." I've been following the U.S. House Special Committee investigation on January 6, 2021. As someone who has taken part in campaigns for both Republican and Democratic candidates, this is not a political event. It is about supporting our Constitution and defending our democracy. It is an opportunity for an educational moment for the American public. If you watch a network that has neglected its responsibility to the American public to cover the hearings, I suggest that you change the channel and pay attention to what is being said. This is an important accounting of American history and that even most Republicans agreed was necessary in the immediate aftermath of that horrible day. Some Republicans, like Representative Liz Cheney, have now put country over party, knowing the peril that we face. But far too many want to ignore the hearings, even the testimony given under oath by top advisors in former President Donald Trump's administration and campaign. To ignore these hearings is to ignore a threat to the most important part of a democratic republic, elected officials' willingness to relinquish power when they have lost. If we no longer have that, then we no longer have a democracy. This is the threat we face. I hope we rise to face it head on, and it starts with working to understand what led to January 6th. And that was a letter to the editor from Dan Voss of Atkins. This is a guest column from Nicholas Johnson. Listening to Washington and McLean. George Washington warned his friends and fellow citizens there could be days like this in his farewell address of September 19, 1796. Political parties could become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to usurp for themselves the reins of government. Individuals may then seek security and repose in the absolute power of an individual, and sooner or later the chief of some prevailing faction turns this disposition to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty. Let there be no change by usurpation. It is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. Are you old enough to remember Don McLean's song American Pie about the day the music died? It will be nothing to sing about, but we're headed toward the day democracy died. Some say it's already dead. The day democracy died was January 6, 2021. It's more complicated than that. Like preparing your garden soil in the spring, a democracy can only grow in a nation with, 1, a civil society of non-governmental and non-business organizations, from Rotary clubs to garden clubs, trade unions to Wordle groups, and 2, people who understand and reject authoritarian rule and affirmatively seek democracy. The first was found in America by de Tocqueville and published in 1835 in his Democracy in America. The second was made clear by Thomas Jefferson in the 1776 Declaration of Independence, listing and charging the King of Great Britain with a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny. Many components, properly assembled, can become a car. Similarly, a democracy only emerges with the assembly and maintenance of components, a non-political respected judiciary, a trusted electoral system expanding participants and easing voting. Thomas Jefferson considered independent media so essential to democracy that choosing government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. George Washington thought education a component. In proportion as the structure of a government gives force to public opinion, it is essential that public opinion should be enlightened. How to destroy a democracy? As the Nazi Hermann Goering explained, it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship. It works the same in any country. The authoritarian's playbook isn't complicated. You destroy the public's trust in its democratic institutions, promote divisiveness, fear, and anger, repeat the big lie until it's believed by the faithful, convince the public the media is the enemy of the people, Or, as in Iowa currently, you attack the public education system, prescribe the books and subjects that can and can't be taught, reduce the appropriations, demonize the teachers. It works the same in any country, including ours, just like George Washington warned us. Again, that's a guest column by Nicholas Johnson, who is the author of Columns of Democracy. And now we have time for a few sports items. This is regarding high school baseball rankings. City High and Prairie earn highest rankings, both teams unbeaten last week, both second in 4A with 21 wins each, by K.J. Pilcher. Iowa City High and Cedar Rapids Prairie produced perfect stretches last week. The Little Hawks went 4-0 while Prairie swept three doubleheaders. Both moved up four spots to earn their highest rankings in the latest Iowa High School Baseball Coaches Association poll released this week. The Little Hawks have soared to second and Prairie has climbed to fifth in Class 4A. Both are tied for second in the class with 21 victories, three back of top-ranked Johnston. Overall, we've remained consistent, City High coach Brian Mitchell said. We've had some big wins against good pitchers. We have to learn to finish off doubleheaders and to help us reach higher levels, however. City High split with 3A No. 5 Cedar Rapids Xavier on Monday at Mercer Park, moving to 21-7 overall. It swept Dubuque Senior and Linmar last week, despite missing Gavin Koch and Jake Mitchell to injury and John Klosterman, an Iowa State football signee who is in Ames. A strong nucleus of players, like Gable Mitchell, Cade Obermuller, and Joey Buska, have helped the Little Hawks overcome some midseason adversity. In our sweeps last week, we really had to dig deep, Mitchell said. Not one game was easy, but we really have started to relearn our identity without Koch and Klosterman in the lineup. Prairie opened this week with a doubleheader sweep of Waterloo West, improving to 21-6. The Hawks have won eight straight games, sweeping 3A No. 6 Dubuque Wallard and West Side rival Cedar Rapids Jefferson on the road and Pleasant Valley at home midweek. It was a good week for us, Prairie coach James Nelson said. We won six games. In 3A, Xavier and Western Dubuque flip-flopped positions from the previous rankings. The Bobcats jumped to third from fifth, and the Saints dropped two spots. Independence remained eighth, and Waymack Conference foe Clear Creek Amana sits in ninth. The first six teams in 2A remain the same from a week ago, including third-ranked Cascade and No. 5 Dyersville Beckman. Mid Prairie continues to occupy eighth. Lansing Key and North Lynn are the lone area teams in the 1A rankings. Key has been a top-five team all season and comes in at No. 4 for the second straight week. The Lynx are close to clinching the Tri-Rivers Conference West Division title, leading by two with four games left. They are ranked sixth. From Prairie to the brightest basketball lights, Iowa's first NBA lottery pick definitely wasn't hidden at Cedar Rapids Prairie High, by Mike Halas. Keegan Murray was no big secret in high school. He was a Class 4A first-team All-State boys basketball player at Cedar Rapids Prairie, as a senior, averaging 20.3 points. He was named the Metro Player of the Year. See if this seems familiar, Iowa fans. Murray scored 34 points in a Prairie win at Cedar Rapids Kennedy that 2018-19 season and got nine of them in a 59-second span. It wasn't like he was completely under the radar, said his Prairie head coach, Jeremy Rickardson, even though he was. From the 2019 All-State list, DJ Carton of Bettendorf was signed by Ohio State. Patrick McCaffrey of Iowa City West went to Iowa. Noah Carter of Dubuque Senior chose Northern Iowa. Keegan and his twin brother and second-team All-State, Chris Murray, had little in the way of Division I offers, so they went to DME Sports Academy in Florida for a year. 3 years later, Keegan Murray will be selected early in Thursday night's NBA draft in New York. The first lottery pick to ever come from Eastern Iowa will be an Iowa Hawkeye and a Prairie Hawk. I was fortunate enough to coach Keegan and current Hawkeye Chris when they were in 7th and 8th grade, and then again when they were sophomores, juniors, seniors in high school, Rickardson said. I flash back to when they were in junior high, tiny and scrawny. When we moved them to varsity as sophomores, they were probably 6 foot tall and 130 pounds. They could shoot it, they understood the game, they made the right plays, but you just could not begin to predict where Keegan and Chris both are. They grew 5 inches, probably, between their sophomore and junior years and another inch or two the next year. So when they left, they were 6'7 or 6'8, but they were still pretty slight. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 22, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.